May it please the Court, my name is Sohil Shah and I'm here on behalf of Defendant Appellant Norman Shah. There are a number of grounds for this Court to reverse Mr. Shah's conviction for possession of contraband while in prison. First and foremost, the government simply failed to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the substance purportedly confiscated on Mr. Shah contained any measurable amount of heroin.
So what about the chemist? You know, her testimony that she tested them, in her opinion it was heroin. I understand you're saying it's not sufficient. What test would you propose that we use to make sure it was a sufficient determination?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, if I can talk about the tests here, I don't know what tests are available at the chemist's disposal other than the tests that she mentioned. But if the chemist is unable to determine a quantifiable amount of heroin, our argument would be that if you cannot assign a numerical weight to the amount of heroin in the substance, then it's not heroin. She performed a few different tests. And at trial, when she was testifying, she performed two color tests, the Mahey and the Markey color test. She testified that these tests are presumptive. She stated, quote, "doesn't tell me specifically that the drug is present in the sample, so I can't say that it is definitive, but I can say that it looks like something may be present in the sample." She then performed the gas chromatography and mass spectrometry test combination. And while she did conclude this test indicated that each of the four rocks contained some amount of heroin, she was unable to measure the amounts of heroin in each rock. She then performed the gas chromatography test on her own.
Why is that significant?
Because if you take a test and you cannot determine as a matter of DEA policy what the quantifiable weight of the heroin is, we would argue that it's not heroin at all, that it could be another substance.
That's an interesting observation. You mean that the expert examines the rock, says it contains heroin on every test she gives, but she doesn't name the amount, and you think she's that testimony isn't indicative that it's heroin?
Yes, Your Honor, because...
Well, that's an interesting observation.
Well, she only performed one test that said that...
How many tests do you have to perform if you find heroin in the first test? You don't have to redo it.
That's a good point, Your Honor. But she also stated that as a matter of DEA policy, because the purity level was so low in the substance that was tested, the lab doesn't even go forth to measure the amount of heroin because they are unable to determine the quantifiable weight of the heroin. If you take a dollar bill, for example, you know, we use examples in our brief, and I guess our argument here is that it leads to a preposterous result. If you take a dollar bill, the general knowledge is that dollar bills may contain some amount of cocaine on them. If the chemist were to run a test on a dollar bill and it produced a negligible amount of cocaine, it doesn't turn that dollar bill into cocaine. And that's the same thing going on in this
case.
All
right, you've answered my question. Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor. Additionally, we'd like to point out here that we cannot locate a single case in the Seventh Circuit where the government brought an indictment and a conviction was sustained without presenting evidence of a measurable amount of contraband in that substance. It's important to note here that the government also was unable to locate a case within the Seventh Circuit where they brought an indictment and sustained a conviction without presenting evidence of a measurable amount of heroin. If there's no further questions, I'll move on to another issue. The district court also committed reversible error here by denying Mr. Shah's motion to learn the identity of the informants and cross-examine them. It then compounded that error further by allowing a prison guard, Lieutenant McDonough, to present hearsay testimony at trial as to what the informants stated to him out of court. The ultimate issue in this case is whether Mr. Shah possessed heroin. And Lieutenant McDonough's statements here were inadmissible hearsay. First, he stated at somewhere approximately between 11 and 1 o'clock during the day that an informant told him Mr. Shah was in possession of heroin. Later on, he stated that a second call came into him around 5 or 5:30 that same day, stating that Mr. Shah was definitely carrying heroin. In Williams, this court said that hearsay is excluded for three reasons. The declarant is not under oath when he made the statement. Because the declarant is not present at trial, his absence deprives the trier of fact the opportunity to assess his demeanor and credibility. And number three, the declarant doesn't undergo cross-examination. We feel that the situation in Williams is similar to the case here. Mr. Shaw didn't have an opportunity to cross-examine the informants because the district court denied his motion. And then it went further and allowed the statements that the informants made admissible at trial. The prejudicial damage against Mr. Shaw far outweighs any probative value of these statements. They go to the heart of the issue here that Mr. Shaw possessed heroin or contraband. What happens when these out-of-court statements are admitted into court is it allowed the jury to form an inference or an impression in its mind that because these informants made these statements, then they must be true. In Williams, the court also stated that there's a clear distinction between an agent testifying about the contents of a conversation between the agent and the informant and whether the fact that he just spoke to an informant.
Yeah, but here, number one, he didn't object at trial when this testimony came in. And then he said in his opening he was a victim of a conspiracy. The prison officials were trying to blackmail someone they were upset with, and he was a scapegoat. So the court lets that testimony in to rebut what Shaw had said. And Shaw discussed those calls in the opening, and we're under plain error review. So you have a hard road to hoe.
Yes, Your Honor, I understand that. But there's a difference between when a criminal defendant addresses those statements in his opening statement or his closing statement, which I believe he did also here, and having the ability to cross-examine those informants. The power of cross-examining those informants is much greater in the minds of the jury than a defendant making a statement on his own, and he should have been given that opportunity here. This court said in Williams that the jury forms an impression in its mind that because an informant said something, it must be true. He should have been given the ability to cross-examine those informants at trial.
He was able to argue that the heroin had been planted on him, right?
Yes, Your Honor, in his opening and closing statement. That's correct, Your Honor. There are no other questions. Move on to a different issue. We have a unique situation here dealing with the work product privilege. We argue that the district court violated Mr. Shaw's work product protection when it called a laboratory that was appointed as Mr. Shaw's agent or expert, one, without his consent, and then two, proceeded to reveal the contents of that conversation in open
court. Contents were that, was there a test? Yes.
I'm sorry?
The question was there a test?
Right.
They didn't ask the result of the test.
That's correct.
Well, now what difference does it make? How could it be an error?
Well, because here, Your Honor, when the district court judge placed that phone call and asked whether the test results had been delivered to Mr. Shaw, it created an inference in his mind, we believe.
In whose mind? The jury's mind?
In the judge's mind.
Oh.
We believe it created an inference in the judge's mind that the test results had come back. They were not what Mr. Shaw wanted them to be. Therefore, he did not.
Couldn't Mr. Shaw have brought in the tester himself?
I'm sorry?
Couldn't they have subpoenaed in the results? Did he have the results, by the way?
At that time, during the April 15, 2014 hearing, Mr. Shaw stated that he had not had the results sent to him yet.
Could he have asked for it?
He could have, but he wasn't given
It was his employee or his designated expert.
Yes, Your Honor.
And he didn't ask for it?
Well, there's a couple of things that happened before the April...
No. Did he ask for it?
Did he ask for the results?
Did he ask the tester to send him the result?
Yes, he did.
Did he get it?
At that time, he stated he had not received them yet.
Did he get it?
Ever? No.
Ever?
No.
He doesn't know what it is?
That's correct, Your Honor. Based on the record, he never got the result.
Wouldn't he be curious? What would your implication be from that?
He either had a phone conversation with an employee at the lab who may have told him that the results weren't ready. It's important at the April 14th, 2014 hearing to realize that at an earlier hearing, the court had allowed Mr. Shaw to have Intermountain Labs appointed as his independent expert for two reasons. One, to retest the substance, and two, to analyze the notes from the DEA agent. At the April 15th hearing, the government admitted that it had not sent the results of the notes, copies of the notes, until 3 days prior to the April 15th hearing. And that information was conveyed to Mr. Shaw before the hearing, so the impression could be that Mr. Shaw assumed that the results might not have been ready at that time. Because in his mind, the lab was supposed to, one, retest the substance, and two, evaluate the DEA lab notes. We think that this conduct by the district court judge created two problems.
Well, and you're saying Shaw couldn't have said to the court after he reported that he had that phone conversation, "Judge, I'd like to see a copy of the report."
He could have, Your Honor.
Right. Then he wouldn't have known for sure what it was.
That's
correct. Everybody knew that this outside lab was doing the test.
That's right, Your Honor.
So, you know, I can't imagine why he wouldn't ask for the results.
I don't know, Your Honor. It could
have been, because this wasn't a bench trial, so it wasn't an issue of the judge being prejudiced. The jury knew nothing about this, so all he had to do was ask the court to hand a copy to him.
Right, but the court didn't have a copy of the results.
Well, to get a copy for him.
Right, that's correct, Your Honor. But it could have been at that time he felt that he didn't really have that option, maybe because he didn't understand that he did, because the court had already made this phone call. I don't know, to be honest, Your Honor. But in addition to creating an inference in the judge's mind that the results came back and they were not the results that Mr. Shaw wanted, we believe it also created an inference in the prosecutor's mind that the results came back positive for heroin, and that's the reason Mr. Shaw
didn't. But the prosecutor never acted on that inference, never said to the jury, "Oh, he had a secondary test done," right?
That's correct.
The judge never mentioned it in any way.
That's correct.
So even if there was an inference, nobody acted on it.
Well, we don't know that for the judge, Your Honor.
Well, we can look at objectively what the judge did and said for the rest of the trial, and you don't have anything that you can point to show the judge was prejudiced by that.
That's correct, Your Honor. If I can edit that answer, actually, Your Honor, if the judge created an inference in his mind that the results came back positive for heroin, it could have affected the way he treated the rest of the trial and the way it affected his sentencing decisions as well. We just don't know that. And the point here is that...
You have a very low opinion of judges.
No, that's not true, Your Honor.
Oh, that's okay. I may join you. But
the point here, though, is we shouldn't have never gotten to the situation where the ability for that inference to be formed was present. The work product privilege should have allowed Mr. Shaw to interact with his agent without interference either from the prosecution or the judge. The work product privilege is sacred. And in U.S. v. Nobles, the Supreme Court stated that the work product privilege is even more vital to criminal justice than it is to civil litigation. The fact here is, though, that the work product doctrine should not have been touched, and Mr. Shaw should have been allowed access to his agent, and the court should not have interfered. I notice I'm in time for rebuttal, so I will reserve my remaining time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Shaw. Mr. Bone.
Thank you, Your Honors. Jason Baum, on behalf of the United States Counsel. I'd like to begin with the phone call to the laboratory. I believe Judge Shadid was in somewhat of a difficult position, and that's why the phone call was made in the first place. Mr. Shaw had represented to Judge Shadid that he needed a continuance because the lab needed to finish their testing results. What Judge Shadid found out is that that did not appear to be accurate, that the lab had...
You mean it was a lie?
That's what it looks like to me, Your Honor. He told the judge he didn't know the results. When the judge called, the lab said, "We're done testing. He's been informed of the results. He didn't request a copy of the report." So the judge is in a little bit of a catch-22. He doesn't violate the work product privilege. He just asks, is the testing done, to see if the continuance needs to be granted. It doesn't. And as far as the inference being drawn, that inference had been drawn prior to Judge Shadid's call to the laboratory. The prosecutor told the judge, since we've not received the expert disclosure, our inference is that either that the test wasn't helpful to Mr. Shaw, and as this court has pointed out, that never went before the jury. There's no prejudice. The government was already convinced there was heroin based on the DEA laboratory test. Moving to that issue, it's our position that a measurable amount is a binary decision. Either there's zero heroin in the balls that Mr. Shaw pulled out of his pockets and threw on the table and said, here, you're probably looking for this, which itself is evidence that he knows he has contraband. And it's not that the lab was unable to determine the amount of heroin. It was just their policy, once it came back as less than 1%, they didn't find the specific amount. But there's still a measurable amount because it's not zero. She testified that she's completely confident that there was opiates in the gummy wads.
Can you go to this his request for the documents and how he got the disc and not the hard copy?
Correct.
I'm curious why he just got, I mean, his computer time, I'm sure, is fairly limited in the prison. I mean, how many pages were we talking about? Why didn't he get the hard copy?
The pages, I don't think it's specific in the record. There is discussion at the hearing about whether it's between 100 and 150 pages, and certainly there's no we're not contending that it was onerous to provide him with hard copy documents. The prosecutor does say something about for security reasons he can't have the hard copy, and different jails have different rules. It's not in the record in this case that he couldn't have the hard copy, but he certainly had access to it.
At some point he had access to the hard copy?
He had access to to the discovery itself, Your Honor.
Electronically.
Yes, and at the hearing where he asked for the hard copy, he's quoting portions of the discovery that he had already reviewed electronically. We don't think the judge abused his discretion, because the judge does offer him an alternative of, hey, I'll have you brought to the federal courthouse, you can review the hard copy. Mr. Shaw's response is, I object. So we don't think it's an abuse of discretion. Alternatively, it wouldn't have been an abuse of discretion the other way to order him to have the hard copy provided. In this case, it was not onerous. It could have been done. There are cases where there's thousands upon thousands of documents, and I'm sure no jail would want that in the jail cell or wherever with a defendant.
No, that was why not I asked how many pages.
Yeah, in this case,
here.
It was 150, I believe, Your Honor. But this specific number is, but I think at most it was 150
pages. So your office doesn't have a set policy about the written documents. It depends on the institution where the inmate is held.
I think generally our office, the practice is to put it electronically just to save paper. I think that's how it was done in this case. But there isn't a policy. I think generally we defer to what the institution where the individual is being housed wants. But it could have been provided in this case. It just, we don't think it was an abuse of discretion not for it to be provided electronically. I do note that the record, too, Rule 16 obviously doesn't provide what manner the discovery has to be provided
in. And
he
didn't make any specific requests after he did the electronic review of certain written documents.
That's correct. And the prosecutor said that as far as Rule 16, there was very little actual Rule 16 discovery. Most of it, I believe, was Jenks Act material, which was obviously tendered prior to trial.
And one other thing, you said he waived his argument about the informant's identity, but he said he wanted to cross-examine them. So how could he do that without the identities?
No, that's right. He started by saying, I'd like to cross-examine them. As that hearing went on, he said, I don't care about the informants. I'm not asking about them. You can talk to them ex parte. I recognize that he's a pro se litigant, and I think his strategy of how do I get the names changed throughout the course of that hearing, it just seems that he's in a pretty weak position to, at the end of that hearing, say, I don't really want their identities, to now be saying, well, I needed their identities. But even if we reach the merits, I don't think it was an abuse of discretion to withhold the non-transactional informants' identities, especially. This court's recognized that informants on the outside of prison, there's a valid reason to protect their anonymity for threats of reprisal. That policy would be only heightened, we believe, within a federal penal institution where many inmates are already there. Because an informant has cooperated against them, we don't believe an informant's disclosing an informant's identity within a federal prison would be a good idea, and we don't think it was necessary in this case because, again, they weren't transactional witnesses or informants to what happened here. They merely were what prompted the law enforcement to go find Mr. Shaw in the first place, and then the evidence regarding his possession when he pulls it out of his pockets throws it on the table and says, this is what you're probably looking for, that is sufficient. There are a number of other issues. I think I've addressed the two that the court requested the parties. I'm happy to address any other questions, but if there are no further questions, I'll concede the balance of my time.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Bowman. Mr. Shaw.
Your Honors, I'd like to start out by responding to counsel's discussion of the written discovery issue. Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 16 doesn't have a requirement for the form of production of documents to a criminal defendant or vice versa. But here we believe that the production of the documents on CD and electronic form ultimately hurt Mr. Shaw. He was a pro se litigant. He didn't have an attorney who had unlimited access to a computer to view the CDs. And it's important to remember that while he was in prison, he had a strictly regimented schedule. He couldn't just go to a computer room to view the CDs whenever he wanted to. He had to sign up for access to the computer room far in advance. He was only given a few hours at most at one time. And while he was viewing those documents on the computer in the computer room in jail, he was taking notes on what the documents were. It's not as if he were analyzing the documents at the same time, because he had to furiously copy notes down from the documents to understand what the substance was.
So why did he reject the court's offer to let him look at the documents in the courthouse?
Well, if you look at the transcript at that proceeding, we understand that he objected to that offer because the court only offered him 2 hours, one day next week, to come view the documents on a computer. 2 hours is not enough time to look through hundreds of pages of documents. I believe the number of documents or pages was somewhere between 100 and 150. It still wasn't giving him the access to the documents that he needed to prepare his defense. And it's important here also because Mr. Shaw tried going to trial without access to hard copies of the documents. And if I can quote a portion of the transcript, I am out of time, Your Honor, if I could have a minute to...
Surely.
Thank you. Mr. Shaw was cross-examining...
So let me just interject here. So what documents, because now you've had access to the documents, right?
Yes.
So what documents has he identified that were so crucial to his defense that he needed additional time and therefore he was prejudiced because he didn't have it?
There is a variety of documents. One was the DEA lab report, which he had to use handwritten notes from in trial when he was cross-examining Mrs. Locks, the government's agent. Others were copies of the FBI agent's reports about their investigation into his apprehension in jail. The others were letters between FBI agents and the DEA lab about the transmittal of the drug and the chain of custody. There's one example in particular here on page 180 and 181 of the trial transcript where Mr. Shaw's cross-examining Ms. Locks, and he says that he has the document, and the court says you have no means to present the document here. And Mr. Shaw responded, you don't have it, presumably referring to a computer. The court said, we have the capability, but you need the machinery to do it. Mr. Shaw responded, I thought that was already set up. The court, in part it is. In part it is set up. Why don't you ask the questions you want to ask, because it doesn't appear you're going to be able to retrieve or display a document. That's a clear example here of how Mr. Shaw needed the hard copies of the documents in order to use them at trial, and why an electronic copy was insufficient for him. I'd like to thank the honors for their time, and we ask that the court reverses the conviction of Mr. Shaw.
You were appointed, weren't you?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, Mr. Shaw, thank you for your argument this morning, as well as Mr. Baum, and you do have the additional thanks of the court for accepting this appointment.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, case is taken under advisement.